Previously on the Sound of Football podcast.
The Sound of Football favourite 11 is as follows. We have John Burridge in goal. In defence, we have Tony Adams, Franz Beckenbauer, Roberto Carlos and Bobby Moore. In midfield, we have Paul Gascoigne, Matt Letizia, Trevor Brooking and Zinedine Zidane. And up front, in attack, we have Zico and Dennis Bergkamp. Ladies and gentlemen, there is our favourite 11. So, we hope you enjoy that.
Yeah, I think we win.
I think we win. Everyone else can stop sending their teams in now.
Ladies and gentlemen, coming live from the CN Tower in Toronto, it's The Sound of Football with Graham Sibley, Terry DeFellin, and your host, Richard Whittle.
Welcome to The Sound of Football podcast, and this is episode, I believe, 75, so that's a big marker for you guys. I'm with, as ever, Terry DeFellin and Graham Sibley, and I'm filling in today, so apologies for my flat Canadian vowels. So I thought I'd take advantage of the fact that I'm hailing from the other side of the world, not America in particular, but Canada. And so I thought that would be a good starting point to kick off with a discussion of today's big news and this week's big news, and I'm sure you're going to be hearing about it a lot over the coming weeks, and I'm sure there'll be many, many David Kahn editorials to go through as well. So we're going to be talking about Stan Kroenke's takeover of Arsenal and what it means for US-UK football relations, if it means anything whatsoever. And I don't know, I was just wondering if we could start off by maybe getting any of your opinions on today's news.
I think I should start off as the resident Arsenal fan here.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah, it's difficult to say whether or not this is good or bad. I mean, I suppose Arsenal have been under a period of instability for a few years now with the Usmanov-Kroenke battle, if you were, which turned into very, very much a phony war, really, when they both got close to 30% of ownership. Mm-hmm. I think most people are happy that it's come out that Kroenke has managed to get the majority stake ahead of Usmanov, because far be it from me to actually make any aspersions to a Russian gangster. I mean, a Russian businessman. The guy is very, very unsavoury, and all right, the man who is married to the Walmart heiress is probably slightly safer. In the hands of your club.
I think there's something deliciously international about this group of ownership. It's sort of like it's almost like a Marx Brothers movie. You have these sort of national stereotypes. The guy who's the husband of the Walmart heiress, and you know, this sort of scheming Russian. The descriptions of him, you half expect to see him with a monocle and Lady Bracewell Smith. You know, it seems very much like an old 30s comedy or something.
It does have a whole sort of like Cluedo character set about the whole thing. It's very Agatha Christie, isn't it?
Or indeed the Arsenal
yes,
Stadium.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, indeed, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. They could do a remake. It'd be a good parody. It's interesting too, because there was already, you know, I think there's certainly a sense of apprehension in sort of piecing together Stan could be the next Glazer, and all the reports are that he seems like a perfectly nice fellow. But I think, again, it sort of reflects the problem of ownership and of Premier League clubs or English clubs in general, and foreign investment, is that it's just really luck of the draw. If it wasn't Stan Kroenke, it could have been someone else, and we have to now, our Arsenal supporters in particular, have to go on his good graces that he's not going to, you know, he's not going to close out the Arsenal Supporters Trust, for example, and they seem sort of tentatively optimistic about Kroenke's plans for the clubs, for the club. But it seems that all we have to go on it is his character.
Yeah, I mean, I think so, Richard. I think you have to take him at face value, because that's all you've got.
Well, you've got the fit and proper persons test.
Yeah, this I'm sure he sails through that quite easily.
Well, yeah, if he's heiress to the heiress of Walmart, he certainly will do. Yeah. He has many money. Many money. He's in.
Yeah, and it seems like, it seems like, basically, you know, I think that this will probably be something where he'll fade to the background. It'll be Randy Lerner-esque. We may see him at games once in a while, but I have this feeling that it'll be a little more secure than the relationship, say, with the Glazers and Manchester United. But I think the other interesting thing for this is now yet another American who's come to the rescue, the curse of another English club. And you know, this is just coming off the back also of Roma's Serie A takeover by another American investor. So it seems now that there's many, many Americans now flooding the Premier League in search of riches. And I'm just wondering what your opinions might be on if this, what sort of cultural shift this might represent. Is this just a safe financial bet, or is there a growing cultural interest from the United States in getting involved in English football?
I suspect that possibly it's a bit of both. He said, sitting on that fence there. I think primarily they're going to be in it for the money. I think if you're a businessman and you've made your money out of business, then you're going to make that kind of investment, and ultimately you're going to make money. You're going to want to be looking basically to make money. However, in order to make money, you may feel that the good way of doing this is by, if you like, adapting certain sort of, you know, sporting institutions and sporting ways of doing things from North America, shall we say, and applying them into the UK. It's possible that there's a conception that because I think there's a lot of cultural similarities between the United Kingdom and the United States, that there can be a lot of cross-fertilisation between sporting cultures. And so I wonder whether or not you've got guys like John Henry, who last week I think was talking about, you know, naming rights for Anfield, which I'm sure horrified a number of Liverpool fans. Not that that is necessarily inherently an American thing by any means, or a North American thing, but it is perhaps something that is associated with that sporting culture over there is perceived to be comfortable with. It's sort of like commercialization. Which is, I think, is strangely anachronistic, because I mean, I watch a lot of baseball, and it's in many ways it's incredibly traditional. So I wonder whether or not they're seeing that as a means to an end.
I think there is one thing as well, because there are, although we see that North American sports are very, very commercial, there's not blanket global appeal for a lot of their biggest name teams. So it's very rare that you will see that you will find three or four teams in their top flight, or their only flight, if you will, that are instantly recognisable amongst sport fans across the world.
Do you think so?
Yeah.
Obviously the Yankees are. I would suggest are probably very well known, if nothing else, for the symbol and the baseball caps.
Yeah,
if
yeah.
not actually necessarily for what they do.
No,
they're just
exactly.
such a powerful
yeah.
brand.
I think American sports, in particular, a lot of the leagues have an awkward balance between creating, a wage parity situation, especially with, strict wage cap rules, trading rules, and things like that. So I think, there's an interesting balance in a lot of American leagues, like the NBA and certainly Major League Baseball, and to some extent the NFL as well, with trying to find both allow for certain dynasties to emerge, certain historical clubs to maintain dominance over a period of time, but also to allow for a wage equity that I think would be unheard of in the European
so top do you think flights. that's what would attract investors to the Premier League is a fact.
Well, someone pointed out something interesting to me today, was that there's actually a lot of growing unrest, particularly with the NFL, where there's a possibility of work stoppages in the future. And I think the belief why Americans are so interested in the Premier League in particular is because, again, there's not a huge there's not a huge revolving door in terms of the same. You're pretty much banking on the same clubs attracting a certain amount of support over an extended period of time. But on top of that, because of the way that the player wages works, the transfer market works in Europe, there's actually much more stability to the league season. You wouldn't ever see, for example, a work stoppage in the Premier League based on parity issues.
Because there was the stoppage in the NHL, wasn't there?
There was, and it was devastating to the league prospects. And the NHL has always suffered a bit, especially with it expanded too quickly in the 1990s, and it ended up costing the league a lot of money.
But now, it's had one of its most financially successful seasons.
Yes, but it had to do so after a huge, retooling period, basically after the work stoppage. And it was the same with Major League Baseball. It had a huge knock-on effect and affected TV ratings for a long time. So I think a part of that is definitely because the stability of Europe, the relative stability of European football, at least, is the fact that even though clubs may fold and it's a financial zoo at the moment, the circumstances of which owners are able to take over clubs with leveraging is just so chaotic. But still, there's still this underpinning of stability, at least in terms of the fact that there would never be, you wouldn't really see a stoppage in league play.
So, Richard, you think then that the reason why that US investors are attracted to the Premier League then isn't necessarily because they're looking to impose their own financial structures. They're actually looking for more freedom. They're looking for the kind of more laissez-faire, free market approach that the Premier League has, and the kind of, you can pretty much do whatever you like within reason, which is why you then see, billions pumped into clubs like Chelsea, and then you then see, millions pumped into Portsmouth, which the owners never actually had in the first place, and that club going down the toilet. The rules are in place, such as they are, that allow for that kind of thing. And do you think that that's something that's attractive to US investors?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's sort of a twofold thing. I think that aspect was attractive, but I also think the means by which the clubs earn that money, which was through basically the Premier League splitting off from the FA to negotiate its own television rights. I think what we're seeing now, especially with American investment, is sort of chickens coming home to roost from that decision way back in '92, because by creating this sort of financial behemoth on the back of negotiating television rights deals, you finally saw a breakthrough in global growth of the game being available on American cable stations, for example. And I think there's an understanding that because of this now, the Premier League is definitely a growth sport. There's a huge, enormous global interest in European football in general, but certainly the Premier League in particular. And I think why American investors in particular are climbing on board is, A, it does provide a certain sense of financial freedom, like you said, in terms of investment. I think it also provides a little more stability in terms of the relationship between the Premier League and players. The players obviously aren't as heavily collectivized in terms of their position of power within the league, although with transfer fees being what they are, it hardly matters. I think third, it's the fact that because they've Richard Scudamore's vision is so grounded in the importance of television and television rights and securing more and more global rights and opening more and more markets. It's a huge, I think, now source of attraction to American investors in particular. Mm-hmm. But I think that's probably a good starting point too, because again, I'm convinced because of this television model that the Premier League has presented, and it's also radically changed the viewer base of the Premier League. And I think that's where you get into more interesting cultural cross-pollination between North America and the UK in particular. So I think that's something that's interesting too to come out of this. I think the idea of ESPN holding the Premier League rights, I think even 20 years ago would have been ridiculous, even from an American perspective, and now it's sort of seen as old hat. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, we know quite a lot of guys from across the Atlantic who are into their Premier League, but obviously, Twitter can create these kind of sort of like networks and get perhaps a false impression as to its popularity. Is it? I mean, not necessarily the Premier League itself, but generally, is the sport is it genuinely growing?
Is it reported in the mainstream press?
It is to a certain degree, and it certainly is more than it was, say, you know, I would say even, say, 15, 20 years ago. And I think the internet obviously has a huge part to do with that. I don't think you're seeing a lot on the Premier League in the mainstream American print publications, but you are starting to see a growing interest in providing a supplemental coverage online. For example, the New York Times now has their goal blog, which has sort of seen a lot of interest from varying American writers. But I think the thrust of the interest is sort of self-generated through a few independent sites that have popped up in the last few years or so. SB Nation is one. There's the BigSoccer.com. So I think a number of sort of semi-independent publications have come up to fill the gap. And I think the interest in these publications is growing to the extent that I think now the print press is starting to take notice. I don't think that they're willing to... I mean, I don't think they have the finances to sort of open up coverage of European football in the print pages, but I think that they are sort of now exploring adding Premier League coverage to their online equivalents.
It is interesting because I have read some quite sort of vehement anti-football articles written in the US press, and I think, well, it must be having some effect there if it's actually if people are going on the attack of soccer, as they would call it. I think that's quite an interesting state of affairs.
It can't. I think there is a conception that the mainstream sports, and particularly the media, the section of the media that cover the mainstream sports in the US, are well aware that soccer has an ability to pretty much conquered the entire world. And there are really only there are some fairly prominent markets where it's still fairly immune, but, you know, even that's beginning to change. And I think that perhaps any antagonism is felt to an extent is sort of, you know, a bit of, well, let's get the licks in now, because we know how this sport can change. As a student of politics, I read a piece of work by a guy called Samuel Huntington, which I mostly disagreed with. But he was talking about demographic and ethnic shifts within the United States. And I wonder whether or not, if indeed that is the case, and whether or not that might explain a gradual change towards soccer generally within the United States. I don't know whether that's something that you can add to, Richard.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think... I mean, we were talking about earlier in terms of the Premier League sort of banking on television as the means for its revenue and growth, and I think that television in particular, and then, you know, the internet culture that sort of followed on that, I guess in the beginning and really in the early 2000s, both of those forces combined have completely led to a cultural shift. I think demographics is part of that explanation, but I think fundamentally, and I've long argued this, and certainly in Canada, that that really it was just the case of Premier League fixtures being available regularly on American cable television. And I think once that started happening, you know, I think it was starting to happen around the mid 1990s, late 1990s, early 2000s, and I think it's been a slow growth process. But I think that the cultural acceptance of soccer outside of the international, like for the long time in North America, the only conception of soccer at all happened during the World Cups, because that was when it obviously had the largest profile. It would make all the front pages of every single North American daily, and then would sort of disappear for 4 years, and people would forget it existed at all. And then gradually, as the sort of European club sport made it onto television, it was just on TV. And then I think it was sort of a snowball effect. And then beginning when the internet happened, it sort of allowed people to suddenly fill in this media gap because none of the papers were covering it, even though it was on television. And then I think that sort of got to the point where the old stereotype of soccer as this sort of foreign game is starting to erode. I think it's sort of now viewed as a tired stereotype.
Yeah, well, it's not an uncommon sport now in North America at all, is it? I mean, no. Especially amongst the middle class as well. That's the impression we're given.
Soccer moms.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, it's also seen as something that you know is played by children.
Yes, there is an aspect of that, but I think. I think a number of things have sort of gradually chipped away at that. I mean, I think if you use MLS as the sort of bellwether for that thinking, at the beginning, there was a definite sense that MLS clubs were marketing themselves to the sort of soccer mom phenomena, you know, parents, you know, trucking their kids off to games. And the only encounter that most American middle-class families had with soccer was their kids playing it at school. And that was the stereotype for ages. And I think if you see now newer MLS clubs, if you look at like Toronto FC, for example, is a good example, or the Seattle Sounders in the United States, and also the Philadelphia Union, they sort of abandoned this trying to market to families like a good night out or a good afternoon out at a soccer game with your kids, and now it's definitely, you can see it's almost nakedly modeled on the European sort of what's conceived or perceived as the European supporters model of people waving scarves and singing terrorist chants and all that sort of thing.
That's a good thing, though, isn't it?
That is a very good thing.
I mean, I haven't seen the Timbers since they've come across, but I did see. I watched them play on the internet. I watched them play the Sounders in a US Open Cup game at home, and it was something else. I mean, all right, okay, mm-hmm. it wasn't a big ground, but I mean the passion of the supporters was there to see, and I must confess to being somewhat surprised that a level of passion for the sport existed at all. And again, I mean, this is obviously a lazy stereotype in my part, but I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, when I watch TFC games, leaving aside the general awfulness of the team, it's a tragedy that they are so awful, actually, because, I mean, that's a fantastically supported club. They sell out, yes, and Seattle, a great story. And are we to expect the same? Obviously, Union as well, who the Sons of Ben campaigned for an MLS club and got their way. Whatever people may think about Philly as a sporting nation, you know, that's still a pretty impressive achievement.
Go Flyers.
And the Flyers suck. And, and Impact de Montreal, which, I mean, could we just maybe talk a little bit about Canadian football since we've got you on here? I know this wasn't exactly what you wanted to talk about, but, you know, hey, it's our podcast, our rules.
It is, yeah.
I mean, how do you see that with Impact, with Montreal Impact coming in and now with Vancouver in there? I mean, do you think that this is a leading edge of maybe a renaissance in Canadian football, or do you think that it's probably going to be more like it is over here, where, frankly, our domestic league doesn't really care much about the national team, unless they're winning, of course, in which they care hugely about it?
Well, I think Canada's sort of in this interesting position because, I'm a great, again, like I've said repeatedly, I'm a great believer in the importance of television access to European football sort of being the foundation for the growth of interest beyond the sort of participatory level and also beyond interest in the national team. I think Canada led the way. I tell a lot of people this, and especially Europeans, and they sort of will sometimes look at me slack-jawed, but there was a time where for a basic cable package, and you're looking at something, you know, that used to be in the $30 to $35 range, and almost everyone had basic cable, you could watch three Premier League fixtures on a given Saturday and two on a Sunday. And on top of that, you could also watch a Serie A fixtures both on Saturday and Sunday. And that's pretty much continued since the end of the 1990s. And I think for a long time in Canada, there's always been an interest in the game in terms of we have what is often referred to as a multicultural population. And for a long time, that was always seen as the primary source of interest in soccer in this country. So, you know, back in the NASL days when you had the Toronto Blizzard, you might get 2,000 people out for a regular game. But when Juventus would come for an international friendly, you'd get 30,000 people coming out of the blue to sell out Exhibition Stadium in Toronto. So I think there's always been an interest in football culturally, but I think what happened was with television saturation in the 1990s and early 2000s is that it really created a young generation who are interested in the professional club side of the game. So I think what happened with Toronto FC and why there was such a huge interest when the club started is that there was a real sense that people in their 20s and 30s who had grown up watching European club football on television wanted a sort of a recreation of that atmosphere at home and were willing to sort of take the risk with MLS, regardless of what you think of the quality of play, to say, well, you know, okay, it's not as much important about the quality of play in the league, but it's actually just about allowing a venue for us to express, you know, our desire to create a real football culture in this country.
Yeah, no, I wasn't attempting to be disparaging of the MLS in general, just of TFC. I want to make that abundantly clear.
Exactly. And it was, yeah, as someone who's actually seen Toronto FC get their ass handed to them at home, I completely agree that it's not necessarily an MLS-wide problem of quality, but it's certainly that Toronto FC is not exactly the emblematic of MLS play as a whole. But anyway, I think I think that in some sense that Canada's always been a bit ahead of the curve in interest in the club level. So I think I think the problem is that interest is there. That interest is among young people, which is what you want it to be. And I think the problem is that we have an extremely outmoded national development setup. We have one of the worst soccer associations of a country of our size and our relative interest in the sport, which is not helping. They just voted to reform. It's a long story and it's quite dry, but they basically just the Canadian Soccer Association just voted to reform its governance structure, which may or may not yield some interesting changes in the player development model down the line. But I think Canada's in this weird sort of nether region between having an extremely active young base of fans wanting, you know, a better professional product, and at the same time having this extremely outmoded soccer association.
Food for thought.
Now we're getting towards the end of the podcast, Richard. So, I mean, do you want to bring things back to just very briefly to where we started again? About anything else you wanted to raise with regards to, you know, US and UK cultures and maybe any potential culture clashes?
Well, maybe I'm just interested in what your perspective is, especially as people who write quite frequently on the internet and who podcast, is that obviously that seems to be this meeting ground now between North American fans of European football, and I'm just wondering what your take is in the last few years, whether you've noticed a growth on our side of the pond and how it's sort of generally been perceived in the United Kingdom.
I think most people in the United Kingdom don't realise it's happening. Most people in the United Kingdom are pretty much focused on their own clubs. Their internet activity is largely internet forum based. Although, I spent a lot of time on the Crystal Palace forums, you know, before Twitter existed, and before I even did my own blogging. And you would get and speak to Palace fans from all over the world, really, including the United States. Mm-hmm. But there was always that kind of expat element to it. Mm. I don't think you ever got that kind of notion that these were actually people who were native of their land, and for some reason. And why would you, if you were living in, you know, in America, why the hell would you support Crystal Palace unless you were some kind of mad person? I suspect it's not necessarily that well known. Certainly within our own sphere, we do talk to a lot of people who are from North America, and they're big fans of football in general. And you know, obviously the English Premier League in particular. But I mean, I speak to people who are into, because I do a lot of Bundesliga work, I speak to a lot of people from America who are big Bundesliga fans. In fact, I go to Sarge to say that, you know, my Bundesliga podcast, the Bundesliga show, which is out every week, listeners, is I would suggest is listened to perhaps more by people from the United States than it is by the United Kingdom. I think that there may be this feeling that you know, to an extent, that the Americans are coming and that they're starting to. The people, obviously, we treat the sport incredibly seriously, but an increasing number of them are treating the sport very seriously, and also their national team very seriously.
Yeah,
I think is probably more worrying from an England fan point of view.
I think. I mean, like, you know, it's difficult. It's like what Terry said earlier about the fact that, you know, shrinking bubbles in your Twitter sphere, but it's. From what I gauge from most North American fans that I follow or follow me, is the fact that there is a general interest in a lot more in all things football rather than just focus on clubs.
Mm.
Over in the UK, I mean, the club specific blogs and websites are
monster.
hugely more subscribed than the independent general football sites. That's where the majority of opinion and you know, traffic sits quite well, actually, because most of it is unreadable fan based stuff. But yeah, obviously there is some good stuff there. I think that's why if you're a general blogger or podcaster, you will find an appreciative international market, because people just will want to take anything football, and there won't be that much focus on individual clubs.
I think that there is this. I mean, I remember when Landon Donovan made his debut for Everton, and at the time, a lot of American US tweeters were absolutely blown over with enthusiasm, and I think it was the same when Jozy Altidore made his debut for Hull City, that here was an American playing in the Premier League. Now, I mean, obviously, from their point of view, this is a great step forward for America, for the US, you know, in football, and that, you know, helping to, I don't know, whether to attach legitimacy to what they do, or whether or not because they have a, you know, broader ideas of seeing, you know, their best players playing in the best leagues. That just wouldn't happen. An Englishman would never get excited about another Englishman playing in another country, with maybe with the possible exception of when Paul Gascoigne moved to Lazio in the early 90s.
Or to the opposite extent when Beckham went over to LA.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was just with snorts of derision. I think most people didn't. But then, you know, I genuinely think that whole period is completely misunderstood about that.
But, I mean, I could be wrong, but I still get this impression that, you know, for example, like MLS is a really good example. It used to be that it was just this sort of blithe assumption, you know, especially reading the blogs and things like that. And, you know, you have to sort of take it with a grain of salt, because anytime you read these things, especially online, they're not always representative of a huge, you know, cultural base of people. But at the same time, I still get the sense that, you know, it used to be that, like, even the discussion of MLS in the United States and in the United Kingdom would just sort of be seen as a joke. And even now I'm starting to see more and more interested, you know, not taking seriously necessarily, but certainly an interest in. My cat's on the table here now. hope he doesn't hit the mic here. You know, just an interest in taking MLS a little more seriously. I mean, Chris Nee's always been sort of at the forefront of that as well, and I've now noticed there's like an MLS UK sort of fan blog site, and I think there's this. It just seems to me that I'm, you know, the old stereotypes just seem to be ebbing away ever so slightly. Again, that could be just me reading into a few things too much. But
when David Beckham moved over there, there was a TV show that was brought out on one of the major terrestrial networks over here.
No, it was on Five.
I must confess, it bombed completely. But there was this attempt to try and engage with the fan base over here with what David Beckham was doing. Obviously, as you can appreciate, he's got a a huge number of fans, people who just loved the guy. And so I think they tried to engage with him here. I suspect also with guys like Thierry Henry, certainly with Thierry Henry going over there, has had some effect as well. That, and I don't know, I mean, as to whether or not designated players, or I forget, I don't know what they're called, but whatever you may think about the idea of getting the, you know, high guys on high wages coming into the MLS, they certainly do, I think, in a lot of people's eyes overseas, raise the legitimacy of the MLS. I mean, it's a league I've been following on and off since its inception, and you know, I've been quite impressed with the way that it's just decided to just go its own way and try to be as, all you know, to an extent as organic about it as possible. But this move then to bring the big names in, I suspect there's an element of risk, and I'm not sure I think it's contrary to their overall spirit. I think they were kind of fine, and I'm concerned.
It does smack of short termism.
Yeah, or impatience.
Yeah.
Maybe I think there's an aspect of that.
I'm sure they know something that we don't. I'm certain that they do. But it just you do have to
I think most people are waiting for the 70s to happen all over again. You know, the aging superstars going over there to like live out their retirement.
That's not going to happen.
But no, exactly.
I mean, apart from the US, MLS is expanding into solid, safe football markets.
Yeah,
you know, into Seattle, into Portland, into Vancouver. Obviously, Philadelphia. These are areas where there are football supporters, and they're going to go. They go along, and so far, so good. But I think you're right that the perception is, I think, in a lot of it. And of course, I suspect there's probably a lot of people who would quite like that because I think that they would look at certainly at North American soccer, both in the United States and in Canada, and be mildly fearful about what happens if these guys really do take this sport seriously. They'll make an enormous splash, and which could, you know, we could see a big exodus of the best players going over there, or it could see a reshaping of the international leagues and international competitions. If the Americans they are still a very, very large economy, and they have a huge amount of sort of political influence and cultural influence. If they started to get rolled up their sleeves and said, "Yeah, we like football, and we're even going to start calling it football. That's how serious we're taking it, you know. And we're going to get involved and change all of this and do all of this. And you guys don't want to play in a Champions League. You want to come over here and play here." And suddenly it's like, "Oh crikey, these guys suddenly mean business." So there may be an element of sort of like, "Well, let's just keep kicking them while they're down, and hopefully they won't. They'll just lose interest and go away.
Also, as well, is that all the time that the MLS is seen as the much lower rank than the European leagues. The European leagues have got every right to go over and charge premium for their product.
Well, yeah, no, exactly. And of course, yeah, because there's good money to be made on the pre-season circuit, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly.
We're doing the All-Star game and stuff like that.
Well, I think the real element for MLS is actually it's just existing, and I think if you study the history of league professional league football in North America, it's just a constant stop start phenomena. And so, you know, obviously NASL. I mean, the reasons why it collapsed have been so analyzed now that it's almost like no one even has to question whether or not MLS will go down the same route. Don Garber. And MLS in general has done everything possible to not make the same mistakes in terms of overexpansion and ruining themselves. I mean, even the designated player rule itself was sort of done as a preventative measure, sort of to allow a little bit of fan growth via getting a few big names into the league, but at the same time being very, very careful to make sure that certain clubs don't spend themselves into oblivion early. And so I think that the main thing for MLS really, and it's interesting to see how it's gone through these different cultural shifts, like I mentioned before, sort of going through this soccer mom phase and then eventually and now in this sort of, you know, what they call the Europhile element of sort of trying to emulate European football culture. And then I think as long as the leagues just sort of exists over a longer period of time, once it gets into two, three, four, or five decades, you know, touch wood, I think that there'll be the sense of expecting a certain autonomous American soccer culture to just sort of be there on its own. And I don't think we'll ever threaten the major North American league sports, but I think it could definitely get to a point where just the stability of existing for a long period of time will be enough to begin to attract real foreign talent, and maybe eventually foreign investment. Kroenke himself is I think he's a majority shareholder or owner of the Colorado Rapids. So,
well, if I had $40 million, I'd buy an MLS franchise.
I think anyone would. I'm surprised more people haven't gotten involved.
A lacrosse team as well. The Colorado Mammoths.
Yeah.
Really?
They're very Colorado-based.
They're very Colorado-based.
Well, no, all these teams are, apart from the Rams.
Exactly.
Where are the Rams playing these days?
St. Louis. Louis.
I thought they were...
Yeah.
They
used to be the LA Rams. We were watching it.
Yeah. It's that franchising element, and we'll somehow work that out on the Premier League one day.
Yeah, we might have to come back to this, because we're 40 minutes in now, so I think we're...
Oh, whoops, sorry.
No, that's fine. That's fine, Richard. It's been great.
I'm a terrible host. I'm not whipping you into shape.
You'd like to, what is it that he said? The only piece of advice he gave us when we told him about we were doing this, listeners should understand that we sounded out Richard when he was over here about doing this podcast, and I think the one thing he said, whatever you do, keep it short, he said. Keep it short.
Oh yeah! I remember that.
Anyway, perhaps you'd like to talk to lead us out and say cheerio in your inimitable style.
All right. Well, it was a great pleasure, and thanks for talking to me both. And it's a shame I can't see you again and share many pints and screw up my voice before my very important audition.
You don't know what's going on about that.
God, anyone would think it was completely life changing.
I'm totally teasing. I'm totally teasing. I invented that reason for myself.
But you keep bringing it up, though.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know, it's just nice to have an excuse. But no, it was totally my own doing. But great pleasure talking with you both, and thanks for our listeners for tuning in, and apologies again for my flat Canadian vowels, but it was a great fun for me to do.
Thanks, Richard.
No problem. Thank you.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Contact The Sound of Football via our website, footballfairground.com/soundoffootball. You can also get hold of us on Twitter at twitter.com/soundoffootball. Richard appears courtesy of his own website, amoresplendidlife.com.
We'd have to do 12:15, I think, for most of the game starts, at least the Eastern games. The Western games, no, you might as well just not bother.
Yeah,
I think we're going to be in the playoffs. Can't see any reason why not. Let's see. NHL standings. This is embarrassing.
It's a good job we didn't ask this when we were recording.
Yeah. I'm like, let me just check here. Where are we? This is pathetic.
Oh, dear, listeners.
Yeah, we're in the playoffs.
Yes. Fantastic.
And are we in the playoffs? Wow, that's a good record. Way to go, Montreal. You know about their insane playoff run last year, I'm sure.
No.
They basically finished third overall in the league.
Did they really?
Yeah, they were in a hair's breadth of making the Stanley Cup final. Nah. But they were up against, what was it, the Flyers. There you go.
They were the Flyers, yeah.
Flyers.
They were too physical. It was a really...
They're a filthy team, aren't they, the Flyers?
They're a bit dirty. They're definitely dirty against Montreal. That was not a...
They're from the city of brotherly love. How can they be dirty?
I think that's the whole point. I think it's ironic. Yeah.